They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative, open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmers market every Wednesday year-round, located Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years, online at peoples.coop. And coming up next is The Food Show with host Emily Becker.
And when you unravel, the secret will travel.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm Emily Becker. It's December and it's dark and no one's getting nearly enough vitamin D. So I thought we'd talk today about some things that make me feel better about the world. Hopefully they make you feel better too. First, we'll talk with Danae Horn and her work serving guests, many of them homeless, at St. Francis Dining Hall. Knowing that anyone can get a free meal in a non-judgmental and dignified way makes me feel good about our community. Next, Lane Selman of the Culinary Breeding Network will discuss plant breeding and chicories. The beauty and bitterness of a crimson radicchio salad can make the coming season a little more bearable. Still bitter. Then at the end of the show, April Jamison of Garden Ecology will teach us all about fruit trees and winter pruning. Turning my thoughts to planting fruit trees and future fruit harvests makes me almost excited for winter. Almost. Our first guest is Danae Horn. Danae is the assistant director at St. Francis Dining Hall in Inner Southeast, where guests are served meals 6 days a week. St. Francis also offers showers, clothes, blankets, and tarps to anyone in need. Danae is also a caterer and owned a restaurant prior to starting work at the dining hall. Welcome, Danae.
Thank you.
So, Danae, tell us about yourself. When did you start cooking?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to answer that question. I did grow up cooking for my family and was involved in the industry in some capacity or another from the age of 16, but certainly my most significant contribution to the local scene was running Portobello for 8 years, a vegan restaurant.
When did you open Portobello?
Oh, 2008. Yeah. We opened Portobello with $5,000 in the belly of a recession and managed to run it for 8 years.
That's a long-lasting restaurant in this town. That's awesome. And a long-lasting vegan restaurant.
Yeah.
So what led you to your current work at St. Francis?
I am interested in making vegan food and food that is vegetable-driven more available to people who are underserved. And when I tried to make that transition from running a restaurant, which is essentially a casual fine dining restaurant, to forming a nonprofit, recognized that it would be beneficial to have some experience in an industry that caters directly to the houseless. So I got the assistant position at St. Francis Dining Hall, which predominantly serves a houseless population, but often the working poor come in as well. We definitely see more people towards the end of the month than the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So St. Francis, we call it a dining hall. Other people might call it a soup kitchen or a meal site. Tell us all about it. I've never actually been there.
Oh, come on down. Yeah, we're there Monday through Thursday from 10 to 6 and Friday from 10 to 2. Sunday, the parishioners come in and run it from 11:30 to 4-ish because it is kind of a church basement operation. And it's located at 330 Southeast 11th Avenue.
And so people can come in and get a meal. How's mm-hmm. that? What's that process like? Do people come in and hang out for a long time, or is it like just like a cafeteria?
It varies a lot dependent on the individual, for sure. We don't serve a homogenous population, mm-hmm. Which is something that I think is really beneficial for people to experience. Come in and like volunteer and basically meet and greet folks who are the recipient of those services and participate in that process. I think it's really beneficial for the wider community to understand that the houseless population in particular is not a homogenous population. I think a lot of people relate as if there's an archetype, which isn't necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm. What's like the best meal? What do people like the most?
Well, our chef currently, he is known for putting out like 8 different courses is the thing he likes to do. And we often have to scramble at the last minute to find a couple extra hands to help serve, which is a great problem to have, really. Because we really try to diversify what we put, like what we make available for people to eat.
Yeah. Is there one like favorite food that just, you know, if you made it every day, people would be so excited?
I don't think there is. People love mashed potatoes.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, everybody loves mashed potatoes. I don't know about a favorite food.
Okay.
Yeah, I like to push the envelope the opposite direction.
Oh, yeah?
Like, what is it nobody's ever eaten, you know?
What are some examples?
Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
For sure. That's partly just a difficult thing to find people to help process on an institutional scale like that.
You mean like actually like washing and cutting?
Right,
and, yeah.
Which is not fun. So last time we served Brussels sprouts, there were several folks who came up who didn't know like what it was, hadn't mm-hmm. had Brussels sprouts ever, and that's an interesting experience. Yeah, an interesting conversation. How can we diversify what we're making available?
Totally.
I think is a question I'm interested in. So.
Yeah. How many people are you serving on average for each meal?
Again, that changes over the course of the month. We see more people at the end. I'd say about 120 a day. And that's just the number of meals that we serve that we're counting.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certainly times when we'll see 200 people in the course of a day.
Wow. That's amazing. So tell me a little bit about how the dining hall is run. You mentioned that you're the assistant director and you have a chef and then you have volunteers coming in. Are the guests that are coming to eat, do they help out too, or is there any other?
Yeah. I mean, in short, it's a community. It has very much of a community feel, especially the longer standing guests. I think in many ways it feels like a living room sometimes. And there are individual tables that people kind of take up, and they're kind of smaller intersected communities within the dining hall community.
So are there other, do you guys do other activities there besides serving a meal, or do people just like want to hang out and chat and eat? And
we have jigsaw puzzles. Sometimes folks come in and play music. I think that a lot of the activities are a bit spontaneous.
Yeah.
There was a lot of Christmas tree decorating happening yesterday.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it spread out and we started to decorate additional trees.
Cool. So. Yeah. If somebody wanted to volunteer, how would they go about doing that?
You can check out our website. Also, if you want to check out the Facebook page, I want to plug that.
Yeah.
Which you tagged as well on the Facebook for the food mm-hmm. show, St. Francis Dining Hall. And currently, as long as I'm plugging things, we do have quite a need for clothing, mm-hmm. Particularly pants. If anyone would like to bring their old pants down to St. Francis Dining Hall, we would love to have them.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you guys have a clothing closet,
we
right?
Do. Yeah.
What what else do you need? Like, how does that actually, just tell us how it works. Like, people bring a donation in and you just like, is there like hangers? People can just come grab whatever they want?
Twice a day for 1 hour, we open the clothing closet and people can come up and ask for specific objects in a size and a color that they're after.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, as the winter is kicking in full bore, we're getting a lot more requests for wet weather gear, warm clothing items, things that we have run out of. And we have a closet full of smaller women's summer clothing right now, which is not particularly beneficial.
Right. So, you're looking for larger sizes, maybe men's sizing.
Yes.
Pants.
Very much so.
Okay.
Yes, please, Portland, bring us your pants. Thank you.
Awesome. So I'm very curious about your transition from running a kitchen, running a restaurant, having that experience of, you know, like, it's very intense, it's very fast, mm-hmm. it's just like constant work, you're working with a small team of people, mm-hmm. You know, what, like, what's that, what is the difference between that and then this other kind of service? So, like, you know, you going from being in the service industry to actually being in service and mm-hmm. like being a place where people are coming to get food and, you know, a little peace of mind, a little time to hang out and relax.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, still probably, I imagine it's still kind of frantic sometimes. Like you just said, you had, you know, sometimes scramble to find some people just to serve the food. So what are the differences there? Like, how are you experiencing that?
There are differences and similarities. I think I have known quite a few people who transitioned from being servers at restaurants into being nurses. And I think of that as just an additional care industry in a certain regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think that servers often know that there's an emotional kind of tax to serving different tables who are sometimes there for radically different reasons. If you go up to table 8, might be there because they just came from a funeral and they're having really intense emotions and you need to be present for them for a brief period of time and assist them. And ostensibly what you're doing is bringing them food, taking their order, bringing them something to the table. But there's an emotional tax to it as well. There's that component. And I think that that kind of work and becoming familiar with doing that kind of work actually transitions really effectively into doing care work. Because in some ways it is care work,
mm-hmm.
Which is undervalued, I think, in the service industry. There's a component to hospitality that is about the heart. So it's very similar in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
Which I wasn't necessarily expecting. And also, in a lot of ways, it's just another restaurant. It, like, the back end, as far as the numbers, that's very similar.
Yeah.
Just looking at how much money is each dish costing? Can we cut costs here? How much are plastic forks? You know,
mm-hmm.
those little questions, those are the same.
Yeah. So there's this idea of radical hospitality that I hear talked about kind of a lot, especially around meal sites and food pantries and other places where people can go and get services. Can you talk, and you were just talking about hospitality in the restaurant industry, can you talk a little bit about what radical hospitality means to you or to St. Francis Dining Hall?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's just the fact that it is the hospitality industry, and it's radical to the sense, to the degree that we're working with. We're trying to address a kind of issue with society on a fundamental root level, which is the radical basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I perceive it, that it's hospitality and it's radical. You know, for instance, as far as veganism, right? I see it as a component of like working towards a more just society is a means of vegan activism.
Mm-hmm.
So doing work that is helpful to people can also be a form of vegan activism.
Yeah.
Addressing just intersecting oppressions and understanding that people who are in these positions don't have the opportunity to choose to be vegan necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing the likelihood that people can make choices at all and trying to better those systems, working towards those, that's a form of radical hospitality.
Awesome. That's really cool. So you're vegan, you had a vegan restaurant. You know, how does it feel, I guess, just personally to now be in this place where you're coming at it from this whole different angle of serving food and like making things available so that people can make a choice in what they're eating, but not necessarily being able to serve all vegan food or something like that. Like personally, do you have any conflicts or does it feel good? You know, how does it feel to just be making all kinds of different food? Because I assume you serve meat and you serve dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
When you can get them.
The thing that I think is, it's interesting. You know, it is something I think about on a regular basis. And people talk to me about how, oh, you're vegan. You know, is it weird to serve the chicken? Well, yes. On mm-hmm. some level, it's weird to serve the chicken. But also, we're making the food that is donated, and the things that are donated are diverse in their own regard. I was talking to someone about how the things that we'll get from the food bank often fall into two categories, three. We get amazing produce. We get some wonderful stuff from the food bank, all kinds of produce, just hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And then we get things that are the cheap food nobody wanted to buy. Sorry, food bank, we love you. That are hot Cheetos, right? We have so many hot Cheetos right now. Nobody, you know.
Wait, like the extra flaming hot ones?
Right, the extra flaming
hot
Cheetos.
Those are too hot.
They're a lot.
They're crazy. I understand why all the grocery stores probably gave them to the food bank.
Right, yeah. And there's this really interesting challenge, too, that is just cooking in the context of donated food, mm-hmm. where it's like a chef show. You know, your grab bag is like 120 pounds of rutabagas and 6 cases of hot Cheetos. Go, right? What do you make?
Rutabaga mash topped with hot Cheetos.
Yes, you're
crushed.
You're great. You're doing great. That's
put me in the kitchen.
Yes. Come on down. And that's the exciting daily task of how do we convert this into something that's going to be delicious?
Yeah.
We give out hot Cheetos and then we bake rutabagas. But we could do croquettes and sometimes we do. Gotten the question.
Oh, you had a third category.
Oh, third category.
Awesome produce, random things that grocery stores don't sell.
Yeah. Third category is the things that were super expensive and wonderful, amazing boutique style foods mm-hmm. that there's just too many of at Whole Foods, and we get those. And that's a really interesting component too, because it's like aged balsamic vinegar plus hot Cheetos plus rutabagas.
Plus one tiny jar of caviar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to work at the food bank, which is why I know some of the foods that you're seeing.
Yeah.
My favorite was at one point there were like 5 10-pound Hershey bars.
Right.
Where you're like, what are you going to do with 1 10-pound Hershey bar versus like, what are you going to do with 5 10-pound Hershey bars?
Yeah.
Novelty things aren't necessarily the best.
I kind of love it. In a way, fun. I kind of love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's a whole different world. You're getting food from the food bank. Are you getting food from other sources?
Yeah. You know, local farmers will bring food in. Portland Fruit Tree Project.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, the community gardens, they brought in a bunch of stuff.
That's awesome.
This last season, they were bringing in flowers. That was wonderful.
Edible or for putting on,
just
out
for the
on
tables.
The tables?
That's, yeah, local community members.
That's such
members.
A great idea.
That was really sweet. We loved that.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
So I am pretty excited. You are just about to launch a new project called Team Underpants.
Team Underpants, yeah.
I want to know what it is. Tell us all about it.
Well, Team Underpants is a nonprofit that is brand new. And if you want to follow us on Facebook, we have a Facebook page. That's pretty much what we got right now. Although I did score teamunderpants.com. Very pleased with that.
Wow.
And what we're going to do is just make clean underwear, you know, brand new clean underwear available to the houseless community in Portland, because our unhoused neighbors have a really hard time finding underwear. Socks are a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Bombas and some other sock companies do really great stuff where they donate one pair of socks for every pair that you buy. So we have had a whole bunch of Bombas for like a year here, and they have been amazing and supportive. But there isn't really a similar program for underwear. And because underwear can only be given out if they are donated new, people can't donate their old underwear. So there was a niche need there, mm-hmm. and we started Team Underpants.
So you're going to be raising funds to buy underwear, correct, or accepting donations of underwear, or both?
Both. Both, both of those things.
Cool. Yeah. And what are you going to do with underwear once you have them?
We'd like to just directly make them available to the social services agencies in town, mm-hmm, that have clothing closets akin to the St. Francis Dining Hall clothing closet, and just distribute them in that fashion.
Awesome. Okay, so if somebody wants to give money to Team Underpants, they should go to the Facebook page?
That's my first recommendation, yeah. Okay. That would be really excellent because we're brand new.
Brand new. Might not even have a way to give money yet.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, but if you follow us on Facebook. Soon. Yeah. Our board got all together last month, and then I incorporated, you know, this, mm-hmm, yesterday officially.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, Team Underpants, but if you follow us on Facebook, that's the next thing that I'm doing. I love that you know that.
I'm so excited. And then if somebody wants to donate to St. Francis Dining Hall or volunteer, yes, or get involved in some other way, how should they do that?
Check out, again, our Facebook page or the website. It's stfrancispdx.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's right. Awesome. Well, Danae, thank you so much for being on the food show.
Thank you.
For our listeners, I'll put links to everything at kbu.fm so you can check out all of that, those places to spend your time and energy and donate some funds that way. Next, I'm going to turn to Lane Selman. Lane is an agricultural researcher and professor of practice at Oregon State University. In 2012, she created the Culinary Breeding Network to build communities of plant breeders, seed growers, farmers, produce buyers, chefs, and other stakeholders to improve quality in vegetables and grains. Welcome, Lane.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want to learn all about the Culinary Breeding Network But first, I want to know what professor of practice means.
Oh,
what's,
yeah,
your research at OSU?
So a professor of practice is a professor that does something that's actually practical. Because sometimes there are individuals that focus a lot on teaching and philosophies, and this is something that is more like your scholarly activities are practical activities.
Awesome. So what kind of research are you doing at OSU right now?
Well, good question. It's a complicated answer. I have at any given moment a lot of different projects going on. When I started working at Oregon State University in 2005, I was actually conducting the research with, you know, other professors, and we would go out into farms and collect the data. And I was much more involved in the hands-on part of research. But as I started the Culinary Breeding Network and have my role really in these research projects is to do the outreach. So getting the information of what we're doing in the research projects out to the public in like a fun and exciting and interesting way rather than just writing peer-reviewed papers. Mm-hmm. So like for instance, right now I work on a project called NOVIC, which is the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative, and that's a national project that we work on like six different crops to try to find varieties that perform really well in organic systems and work with plant breeders.
And is that specifically like in the northern United States?
It's in the northern,
Canada,
yes, exactly. So that is the Oregon State University is the lead, and Jim Myers is the professor and plant breeder at OSU that is the leader of that project. And then we work with Organic Seed Alliance, which is a nonprofit that is a national project. You know, they work nationally, but they are headquartered in Port Townsend, Washington, University of Wisconsin at Madison, and Cornell University. So there are breeders at each of those institutions that breeds, at least for some of their work, is breeding specifically for organic systems. So we work with their breeding lines and varieties we know are going to perform really well on organic farms, as well as new varieties that we don't know how they're going to perform, and we trial them on lots of different farms all over the country. So that's one project. I work on barley as another one. I work on eat winter vegetables, which I hope to talk to you about later in this program. So, you know, probably about six different projects right now to kind of make a full-time job.
Very cool. So most people, I think when you say plant breeding, people get that that's just how you get plant varieties that are good. But what's like the basic? Can you give us like a three sentence, like what is plant breeding?
Yeah, I mean, plant breeding is recombination of genes, right? So it's like for instance, if a plant breeder really wants to have a variety of a tomato that has really great disease resistance but also tastes great, so then they choose parents. Essentially, they choose one parent that is going to have that disease resistance, another one that is going to have great flavor, and then they're going to take pollen from the male, and transfer it just with the paintbrush. This is also, people get really freaked out about plant breeding. They always think that you're talking about genetic modification, mm-hmm. and we're just talking about old school, traditional, classical plant breeding, transferring pollen from one flower to another. And then it's just like if two, and you know, humans have a bunch of babies, they're not going to be, they're all different, you know, genetic combinations. So you have a lot of diversity there. So then the plant breeder would then save the seed from that fruit, plant those all out, and select from that. Then they would see which ones have the disease resistance and flavor combination that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And then you take the seeds from the one you like and you plant them again?
Yeah, you have to
make sure they stay true to.
Yeah, that. So what you want to do is then you find the individuals that you like and fit the description that you're looking for, and then plant those out, and then continue to do selection over and over and over again until you have sort of a stable population of that's what you're getting every single time. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in an open pollinated variety. So you see in like a seed catalog right now, seed catalogs are coming out and you see hybrids, and then you also see open pollinated. And a hybrid is a different type of variety.
Yeah. So that sounds like it could take a really long time to get to a stable variety.
Yeah. So it's a very long process, you know, and so it is where the Culinary Breeding Network comes in. But you think about like a variety of a pepper or tomato or kale or whatever it is probably going to be like a decade long process. Mm-hmm. So if the Culinary Breeding Network, it's convening a lot of different individuals that are stakeholders. I mean, we're essentially all stakeholders, right? Because we are all consuming food. Mm-hmm. So then to make sure that those traits that we want and desire in the end product are discussed with the plant breeders at the beginning of the process than the end, because you can't really go, you know, you can't just add flavor or add disease resistance or something at the end. You need to know about that. The Anthony Boutard, who's a farmer, but he also does his own on-farm breeding at Ayers Creek Farm, always calls it the design brief. So you have your design brief at the beginning, just like you're an engineer or something, where these are all the traits that I want. Mm-hmm. And so to know what those are up front, so that's what you're selecting for in the field when you're doing your breeding work.
Awesome. So the Culinary Breeding Network, you've mentioned a little bit. Can you just kind of back up and tell us, you know, what do you do? Why did you start it? Like, why did it need to exist?
Yeah. So in that NOVIC project that I was telling you about, the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative, we were growing out all these different breeding lines and varieties on a lot of different farms. And it's a very farmer focus and participatory project where we work with all the local farmers that are part of that project that is really open to all farmers. They come and we meet, have an annual meeting, and they tell us what they want us to work on, and they also tell us exactly what they're looking for. So then we would go out and evaluate for those things. So it was all agronomics, though. Let's say it was peppers, because peppers, if you go to the Culinary Breeding Network website, you can read like how this all started, mm-hmm. right? So we were looking for a variety of sweet peppers, sweet red roasting style peppers. And we went out and I would evaluate exactly what the farmers told me that they were looking for. You know, vigorous, they don't lodge, so lodging is falling over, so you want the ones that stand up straight. They have a really nice canopy, so it protects the fruits from sun scald, all these different things. But it was mostly, you know, it was all agronomic qualities.
So like making it easier for the farmer to grow the vegetable.
Right. Because a lot of times, also, to back up a little bit more, is a lot of the varieties that we see in seed catalogs have not been bred for and selected for in an organic environment. Mm-hmm. They could be in a conventional environment in which you don't really know how they're going to perform in an organic environment. Mm-hmm. So in this project, we grow them in organic environments, but not just one, we grow them in multiple, like 9 different ones. So then we can actually know if it's genetics or environment that has the impact on that variety of how it's performing in the right. field. So we weren't doing any tasting, and I know that from, you know, from working with the farmers and also knowing people, it's people aren't going to eat things that don't taste good. So it's like, let's taste these things. And so with the red peppers, there's a lot of different ways you can eat a red pepper, right? You could have them roasted, you could have them sauteed, you could have them raw. So we convened a bunch of chefs. I worked at the farmer's market at that point also for Gathering Together Farm and knew a lot of chefs from that. And so convened a lot of chefs on a Monday during the day when they have the day off. And we ate all these different peppers and all these different ways and evaluated them, had a ballot where they had to give a 1 to 9 rating with all these different attributes. And it was pretty intense for them to have to do that. So anyway, at the end, the chefs actually told me what they were really looking for was just these traits, which were rounded shoulders and straight walls. And that's when I realized, wow, we really need to have the chefs and the end users of these vegetables talking to the breeders mm-hmm. at the beginning of the process so we know what it is that they want.
So not just like a great flavor, but also something that's, I guess, maybe easier to chop, or is that why they wanted the straight
size? Exactly.
Like it looks better on a plate.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about waste in a food kitchen or just being very efficient, the mm-hmm. rounded shoulders in a pepper rather than sunken ones that we're always cutting around, you know,
right.
which might not be a big deal in a home situation. But when we're talking about St. Francis House and you're like cutting tons and tons of hundreds of peppers, then you want the ones that are the easiest to process and mm-hmm. the ones that have the least amount of waste.
Right. Cool. So you started with peppers, and what else? What other kinds of projects or breeding work are you doing?
Oh, there's all kinds of things. There's mild, like low heat habanero peppers. The barley project is actually focused on a naked barley, which is like a barley without a hull. So then you can actually eat it.
Like it's grown without?
It doesn't. It threshes free from the seed. Threshes free from the plant when you harvest it. So then it doesn't have to be pearled. So then it is actually a whole grain and you could just cook it and eat it just like rice. And it's like a whole
really
grain.
Cool.
You're not getting rid of any of the bran or anything. So it's actually transferred to like all of these different crops. And then once a year we do, and it's coming up on February 16th, I organize an event called the Variety Showcase, which is a series of tables, usually about 30 tables that will have a plant breeder that will be showing off their breeding work visually in front of you. So you can see possibly here's a mother and a father and across them, and this is what we came up with. And you actually get to be part of that process and talk with the breeder about what it is you like about the progeny. And there's a chef that is matched up with them that makes like a great dish mm-hmm. because, I mean, they're like our advocates, right? No one wants to come and just like listen to someone talk about plant breeding. They want to eat really great food.
I would come and listen. Yes. But I want to eat too. That sounds really fun. So that's February 16th.
Yes.
So what time?
It's at the Red, and it's on a Sunday, and from 3 to 7.
How would they find out?
If you follow me on Culinary Breeding Network on Instagram is the very best way. There's also a website, culinarybreedingnetwork.com, but the Instagram would be the best. Right now, the tickets aren't up for sale at the moment.
Okay. Cool. So I want to know, I don't know if this is a question you can answer, but are there any new varieties of vegetables or grains that we should be like looking out for in 2020? Is there something new, or maybe not even a new variety, but just something like that's going to be really popular really soon?
Well, there's radicchio.
Yeah.
Yes, we can talk about that. One project that not only just like the focus on the breeding work, but just really getting people like very jazzed about eating what is local, because we still need to do that even though we live in Portland, and so many people go to the farmers market and support local farmers all during the summertime. I mean, really, that's like, who's not going to, right? Everything tastes great. It's like a social event. It's sunny. It's nice. But then the rain comes and it gets dark. And then it's just like, here's the same rutabagas that we had last week to sell. You know, it's like, who's excited about that? Then people go to the grocery store and they buy the lettuce from California and the cucumbers. And I really would like to change that. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing a lot of focusing now and have a grant to with a project called Eat Winter Vegetables. We have a website, eatwintervegetables.com. And it involves 8 different vegetables, including purple spread broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, celeriac, garlic, winter squash, Brussels sprouts, and radicchio. And of those, I would say that people are the most excited about radicchio. I'm one of the organizers of an event called Sagra di Radicchio, and a Sagra is a festival. It's an Italian word for festival in Seattle that we just had in November, and we just did a winter vegetable Sagra down here in Portland a couple weeks ago at the Red. Along with friends and family farmers when they had their Fill Your Pantry event. And people are very, very excited about radicchio. Right now is radicchio season. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy to report, just have to say this because my son is listening. He's 11 years old and he just wants to eat radicchio salad incessantly.
That's amazing.
I'm very excited about it. So children can really enjoy bitterness, earthiness, all these things. So we have these events that are kind of focused around winter vegetables to get mm-hmm. people excited about that.
So radicchio is a kind of chicory, right?
Yes.
So there's all of these different chicories, but I think people only know about radicchio. What are some of your, do you have other favorite chicories?
Yeah, so radicchio, the round one that people are always thinking about is actually called Chioggia. And that is a place that is in Italy, northern Italy, where most of these are all hail from. There is a Treviso, which is one that's a little more like football shaped, same purple color. But there's Castelfranco, which kind of looks more like lettuce, and it's speckly, less bitter. The ones that aren't purple are less bitter. There's Sugarloaf. There's a lot of different ones. I gave you a radicchio zine, which...
I'm so excited to read.
There's a little booklet that all the organizers of the Sagra di Radicchio put together that is available on the Etsy shop, so you can find all of that information on any of those social media channels.
I have a question about radicchio. Do you think it's getting more popular because people like bitter things and they like to eat it, or because it's so pretty and we take pictures of our food all the time and so now we just want purple on our plate?
The latter. And it's because there's a pink one, the Rosa del Veneto, that everyone is completely insane about.
Because it's pink.
It's pink. It's beautiful. And it actually, like, I feel like in social media, you saw it before it was even available. I had, like, Bon Appetit magazine call me, like, 2 years ago, and we're all crazy about it. And I was like, well, actually, it's mostly just imported from Italy and sold in like the New York City area. Mm-hmm. There's not that many people who are growing it. Now we do have the seed that's available, because the one thing that's been a really big challenge and why I'm involved in this really, I love radicchio, but is that the seed quality has not been very good here, because this is a crop that is popular in Italy mm-hmm. and has not really hit it big anywhere else, right? And so we weren't getting the best seed, and now you actually can. The seed is imported here from Italy, and we have very good quality seed, and so there's going to be more and more people that are growing that. But like when people started contacting me about it, I mean, maybe everyone that's listening has seen this, it's crazy. They were calling it pink lettuce. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like bubble gum. It's beautiful. Like, everyone wants to eat it. But I think it's because it's so beautiful. But then, it's like a gateway, and people are going, oh, okay, actually, I do like this. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't have to eat lettuce all year round from California.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you are, I don't know if you're leading or if you're going on, a journey soon.
A radicchio road trip.
Expedition.
Yes.
Tell us where that idea came from and where you're going and how people
sure.
can support you.
Yeah, well, it's been a really interesting thing, because we started organizing these Sagra events here, which are festivals that happen in Italy, right? And I was inspired by that and decided to do those here to try to get people excited about local produce here. But I have a friend who lives in northern Italy who farms there. Her name is Mirta. And she contacted me and said, hey, I really want to do a Sagra here like the ones that you do. And I said, well, I'm doing what you do. And she's like, no, that's not actually how we do it. And, you know, so we went back and forth. And it kind of is this like really cool like synergy of like how things are in Italy and that we're inspired with, and what she sees that we're doing that are very different from the, you know, like the like very rigid traditions that they have in Italy, right? Mm-hmm. And these events that we do here are really focused around education. Like, we make it look really fun, and it is fun, and we get all these chefs, but really in the end of the day, like, this is about social justice, this is about breeding for climate change, this is about really important and very challenging issues that we have to face in the ag world. Mm-hmm. So we're organizing an event called the Jazz that is going to happen in Northern Italy on January 18th, Sagra. And so we said, well, if we're going to be going there anyway, I should probably take like 7 people with me. And we should also make it a road trip through the Veneto and visit seed growers and farmers of radicchio so that we can understand better how to grow this crop. That's one thing that's very challenging and why more people aren't growing it, not just the seed quality, which is now we have more access to that, but how exactly do you grow this crop? It's very challenging. Mm-hmm. And it is information that resides in Italy, but is not often like written down. So I'm going with it's turned into about 25 people.
Wow.
A couple people I want to mention are Josh Volk, who is a farmer and a farm consultant here in Portland, Oregon. He wrote Compact Farms. He used to work at be the farmer at Soviet Island Organics, and now he's at Cully Neighborhood Farm. He's going, and myself and Sean Linehan, who is a photographer I work with, and we will document and photograph and video a lot of what we see there so that we can bring it back and share it with farmers here in hopes that they will be more successful and feel more confident about growing this crop. There's a lot of other food journalists and chefs and farmers that are going with us on that trip as well that are from Washington and Oregon.
Cool. And so how can people support that expedition?
Thank you. We did put together an Indiegogo that you can find if you go to the Instagram, my Instagram at Culinary Breeding Network, then you can see there's a link that goes to the Indiegogo. And there's even $5 level there. And so from that, you get a PDF of all of our notes from that. There's also an option for $5 and you get like a mini cookbook all about radicchio that we'll put together. But anything to help us pay for this trip would be fantastic. We really, I know it sounds very luxurious, but we do.
I want radicchio on my plate. So
we really do
think
need
I will
help
benefit.
Yeah, getting there and think that it is a crop that could have like a really big impact for, we're seeing already that the farmers that are growing it successfully and making a lot of money during the really difficult time of year when they're not bringing in a lot of money and being able to keep people employed through the wintertime.
Right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Lane. Thanks. And again, we'll have links to everything on the Food Show website at kboo.fm/foodshow. Next up, we've got April Jamison. April founded Garden Ecology in 2015, where she specializes in designing gardens and coaching clients on the care of their edible, medicinal, and native gardens. She's also worked with Green Lints, the Malden Court Community Orchard, the Portland Fruit Tree Project, and the Home Orchard Society. Welcome, April.
Hey, thanks.
So we're almost at the end of fall, and it's the time of year. I already talked about this. I'm a little sad. And it's not just because it's dark, but it's also because there's no more fruit to harvest.
No.
I have like 5 persimmons still sitting on my windowsill ripening, and that's it. And so after that, it's gone.
Yeah.
So I think it's a natural time to start thinking about planting fruit trees. Is that true?
That is true. So bare root fruit trees just became available.
What does that mean?
That means that you're not getting them in a pot, so they're just the tree and exposed roots without
like
the soil.
Dirt.
And so they just became available usually in, you know, winter, February, from, you know, I like to point people towards One Green World or Rain Tree Nursery. They always usually have really great, trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can hop on their website and start, you know, looking through all these different fruit trees and all the different varietals that are available right now. And that's pretty fun and exciting to start thinking about that because this is the best time to plant your fruit trees.
Is it the best time to plant any type of fruit tree, or are there some that we have to wait? Like if I wanted a peach tree.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would say that the stock goes pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have specific kinds of fruit that you want to plant, you should hop on it and get the tree and get it in the ground and get the mulch on top and get it all tucked away so that when spring comes and it starts to kind of warm up and the roots can start to kind of root down in the soil more, and then by the time our hot summers are coming, that they have been established in there.
Our so hot summers, sweltering summers that we have here. I'm joking. They're not really that hot.
But they're dry.
They're dry. Yeah. So, okay. So I'm thinking about a tree I want to plant. Let's say I want to plant a persimmon tree because they're awesome. What do I need to think through before I just like pick out, you know, look at the catalog, pick it out and put it in the ground?
Yeah. Well, you'd want to think first about placement and, you know, what does your property look like? Where do you want to put that tree? And is it going to get enough sun? Is there enough space for the canopy to grow out and not grow lopsided because it's searching for light? So where is this fruit tree going to go on your property? And is it appropriate for the size? You know, I always tell people that if you're getting a bare root fruit tree and its rootstock is semi-dwarf or dwarf, and it says on the tag or in the catalog that it's, you know, 12 to 15 feet tall, then you're going to want to give it that much width as well. So you want to really look at your property and make sure you have enough space for that fruit tree. And then you want to go ahead and like look at...
Just a question. So yeah. You said width, but do you mean like the entire circumference would be 15 feet? So on any side, like... 7.5 feet out.
Exactly.
Okay, okay, yeah. Cool. Just want to get the specifics.
Yeah. So, and then you'd want to just make sure that you really love that fruit. Like you love persimmons. There's different kinds of persimmons. Do you like the hachia? Do you like the fuyu, which are the more popular ones? And just making your selection. I really encourage people, persimmons are a relatively pest and disease resistant fruit type, but really look at the pest and disease resistance of the different varietals and really kind of pull that up in your mind and kind of prioritize that when you're making your selection.
So, you know, what other kinds of things? So we want to get a tree that is going to be good for the location we have. Maybe I don't have a spot that's great for persimmon, but I have a spot for something smaller, like a, I don't know, columnar apple tree or something.
Sure.
But so you want to like think about that, right? And then you want to think about the pest and disease resistance. What else should we be thinking about? Like, do I need to know what my soil type is? Because it's terrible.
Well, so soil, a lot of our soils are degraded and compacted, and maybe we have an area that has turf grass that's been sitting there since the 1950s or whatever. And so we have in the Pacific Northwest and Portland, we have really great soil for fruit trees in general. So in terms of nutrients and all of that stuff, what you want to consider is that compaction. And the clay gets compacted. Then it makes it difficult for the tree to root down. So I think the main thing would be really considering adding the mulch, so a woody mulch material. I really love a product that they have at Dean's Innovations. It's Oregon Woodland Mix, and that just has a really nice balance of twigs and leafy material and wood that promotes a microbial dominant soil, so our fun fungi. And that will help to kind of the micro macro organisms start to kind of break down that and aerate the soil, and so then it becomes less compacted and it just becomes better quality and more nutrient rich. And down the road you can think about kind of planting some companion plants. I always love to promote Pacific Northwest native plants as companions, but so that can help with ongoing nutrition.
Do the trees get lonely?
Oh, like they're so lonely. Yeah, they you know, so fruit trees in the wild, they grow on the edge, the forest edge. It's an ecotone between, you know, prairie, meadow, and the deep forest. So that's where there's a lot of biodiversity there. and a fruit tree would naturally grow. So you're almost wanting to like mimic that environment by having some perennial flowers and things that are going to die back and provide new organic matter onto the top of the soil. But you're also going to want to have some twigs and leaves and things like that that are breaking down and really promoting a microbial rich soil and environment.
Awesome. So a lot of people in Portland are living in smaller and smaller and smaller spaces without any kind of outside access. Are there any kind of fruit trees that people could have in a pot, like on a studio apartment balcony or outside their front stoop?
Yeah, I mean, not a lot, actually. It's espalier fruit trees have been really growing on me over the years because they do really well.
Explain what that means.
In compact environments, and they're basically a fruit tree that you train and prune to be, it's basically a wall of fruit, right? It's really narrow, so they can get planted along a driveway or, you know, in the front yard, kind of along the sidewalk. So that would be an option for small spaces. And then in terms of a pot, you know, fig trees do okay in pots. They can be grown in pots, but just recognizing that, you know, that it's a tree and it really does want to root down deep in the soil profile so that it can access nutrients and water. So having it in a pot is a little challenging, right. But figs, if you wanted to try it, you know, figs would be the one to try. But that's also the reason I got so involved with organizations like Green Lens, Portland Fruit Tree Project, and organizations that are really thinking about and promoting and installing community orchards. Mm-hmm. So I still work with a lot of the community orchards throughout Portland, Malden Court Community Orchard in Lens. There's Fruits of Diversity Community Orchard in North Portland. There's Green Thumb in Southeast, Brentwood, Darlington, and so many around town that if you're living in a small space, you're in an apartment, you're in a rental, you know, that to get involved in your neighborhood community orchard, because then you can grow lots of fruit trees with your neighbors and reap the benefits, and they can be healthy, big trees.
Awesome. So once I plant a tree in my house or maybe in my community orchard, you've obviously got to take care of it. And I think the thing that's kind of coming up right now is it's time to start pruning the trees. So can you give us some tips and ideas about what we should be thinking about right now?
Yeah, definitely. We just started winter pruning season yesterday, actually. I just started.
Okay.
but typically you can start, you know, at the beginning of December. And a lot of people are kind of hustling and bustling for the holidays. So most people choose to wait till January. So we've got January and February as the winter pruning season here in Portland in the Pacific Northwest. And you want to just make sure that you have good tools, kind of take stock of your tools. When I do pruning coaching with my clients, I always kind of ask them, bring your tools, let's look at them, let's talk about the tools, because having really good, clean, sharp tools is going to determine how successful you are doing the pruning on your fruit trees. So having a good set of hand pruners, a small pocket saw, and, you know, if you need an orchard ladder, having the things that you need on hand, maybe a pole pruner to help you get to the taller parts of the tree, and then just you know, maybe going to a workshop and brushing up on your skills, because pruning is actually a really hard thing to learn online or in books. And so what a lot of people tell me at my workshops and at the pruning coaching sessions is, you know, hey, I already looked over the books, I tried to research this online, it just wasn't making sense, and I got to my tree and I couldn't figure out what to do.
Totally.
So, you know, it's hard to kind of give a straightforward answer to, like, how to prune it successfully. but you just want to make, if you're going to go ahead and just go for it, make sure that you're not pruning off more than a third of the canopy at any given time, pruning season.
That seems like an easy rule.
Yeah, that's an easy rule. And then another easy rule is to think about the three Ds. So you want to make sure you're getting any dead or damaged wood off with a clean cut. And then you want to look for disease and see if there's some easy branches that you might be able to take off that might have disease. And then disorientation. And disorientation is where more of the nuance comes in. But basically, it means crossing branches that are rubbing against each other. It means branches that are heading straight up to the sky or straight down to the ground. And so you can kind of look for those disoriented branches and make some cuts and make some decisions. But I definitely recommend going to a workshop, and the Home Orchard Society offers a lot of great workshops and pruning. And then I offer the pruning coaching services that really we do the work on your trees at your home, one-on-one, hands-on, and that can be a really great way to learn and get that information.
That's awesome. That sounds so helpful. I also know about a couple other places people can practice pruning. One is Rewild Portland is having this Saturday, just in a couple of days, they're having a pruning Skillshare. It's like you're calling it a permaculture and fruit tree pruning skills class. So that's rewildportland.com, and it's Saturday from 2 to 4. And then, as April mentioned, the Portland Fruit Tree Project works with a bunch of different community orchards around town. So if you go to portlandfruit.org, you can check out all the community orchards, and they'll each have a time where you can come and practice pruning. And I think in the practice of pruning, what I always see people do is look at a branch for a really long time and be like, ooh, I don't know if I should cut it. I don't know. It looks like I should, but I'm not sure. And be really, really hesitant and not want to make a cut because they think they're going to hurt the tree. What would you say to that?
Yeah, there's two types of new pruners. There's the type that, you know, we're hemming and hawing about the decision. We don't want to prune, you know, we don't want to hurt the tree or damage it, and we're taking a long time. That was me when I started. And then there's the really like confident, hack it back, let's just do this thing type of new pruner. And so somewhere in the middle of those. So if you can just understand that if you're going to just go for it and do some pruning on your fruit tree, remember those kind of tips and rules, but also just recognize that this tree is very resilient and that it's going to put on new growth next year. If you made a cut that, for instance, was an inward-facing bud and now the new branch is growing towards the inside of the canopy, you know, and you're like, this isn't what I wanted from my pruning, then you can always come back the next year or next season and refine your process.
Awesome.
So just go for it.
Just go for it. Yeah.
Just go for it. Try it out. And really the thing that I love about fruit trees, and I love growing food and annual vegetables too, but you get to kind of build this relationship with this tree and this plant that's producing food for you and nourishing you ongoing. And so you get to see the cuts that you made and how the tree responded to those cuts, and then kind of amend what you're doing. Just that observation of, you know, how did the tree respond to the things that I did, and being observant, and the trees teaching you kind of how to do it better.
Awesome. So we're all going to listen to the trees, but if we want to listen more to you, April, how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram, Garden Ecology, and my name's April Jameson. And you can also go to my website, gardenecologypdx.com. And I'm on Facebook as well. And so my contact information is all up there for anyone to access. And you can text me, call me, email me, direct message me, lots of ways to contact.
Anyway, yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much, April.
You're so welcome. It's a pleasure.
So that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you have any comments about the show or ideas for future shows, please email us at foodshow@kboo.fm. And if you missed the show or you want to hear it again, you can find the episode at kboo.fm or on the iTunes or Google Play apps. Our next episode will be January 15th at 11 a.m. And until then, I'm Emily Becker. Thanks for listening.
And when you unravel, the secret will travel. It's hard to take risks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, around the world at kboo.fm, and it's time for Jazz Lives. Let's get off to a nice hot start. Figure this out. In the meantime, let's listen to the